Thank you for being here, Senator Bundy, Senator Hoffman, Senator Dyson, Senator Stedman's outside just coming to the table, and I'm Senator Green. We have several pieces of legislation on the agenda today, and be noticed if anyone's here for House Bill 218, the sponsor has asked that be delayed till another day. Still got some work going on that. And we have first on the agenda House Bill 318, which has to do with the limitation on eminent domain. If you look in your package, you'll find that we have Senate Finance CS version R. Senator Bundy, if you would move version R for our work draft.
Madam Chair, I move that we adopt version R as our working document.
Thank you. And I'll object for explanation. And in another committee in this body, the language is added on page, on version P, at the bottom of page 6, line 25, beginning with however, to page 7, line through page 7, line 11. We have deleted that language, and the that takes it back to the original language. The sponsor was requested that, as well as it's my interest to have that language out as well, and, because it kind of guts the actual purpose of the bill. Craig, thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I can sit down. Thank you. For the record, my name is Craig Johnson. I am staff to Representative Lisa McGuire. I would also like to have up Peter Putzier, who is with the Department of Law, who has been with this process from before the first day of session, who can answer a lot of the legal questions, et cetera, et cetera. In the way of background, HB 318 kind of came about in this summer when the Supreme Court made a decision on the Kelo case, which was out of New Haven, Connecticut, which condemned some private properties and transferred them to another private entity for private economic development. There was kind of a ripple effect throughout the nation. As a matter of fact, 42 of the 43 states who've actually been in session since then have enacted or are in the process of enacting legislation to prohibit this type of transfer. The sponsor early on called and said, we have to see if this can happen in Alaska, let's look into it, and we found out that in fact it could. Alaskan laws would allow for this type of condemnation to happen. That set us on the road of trying to prevent that. And as a result of that and the genesis that's come about, you have before you 318. This bill has been vetted. At last count, there were 22 attorneys who have had input into this bill. They range everything from the Department of Law to environmental groups to railroads, oil companies, utility companies. The National Association of Realtors have all looked at this and kind of blessed the concept. We started off with two simple premises with this bill. One is that two policies. One is the appropriateness of transferring private property to another private individual. Once we got into that, we found that the most egregious act that was involved with the Kelo case was they actually took someone's home. There's many people who have been there as many as 70 years, and they took their home and transferred it to a private company. Every place we went and everything we looked at, the key factor became home. It was at that point we decided to add someone's private residence, their primary dwelling place, and start taking a special look at that. The sponsor decided it didn't quite rise to the level of prohibiting it totally, because there are legitimate uses of eminent domain. But it was determined that the ability of one person to recreate doesn't take priority over another person's dwelling space. So we refined that down to basically it's about a 4-acre plot around someone's home that is protected from eminent domain under this bill. This is a bill that no one loves, but most people like 90% of it. It's a good compromise. The American Association of Realtors think that no private property should ever be taken. Environmental groups think anything should be taken. So in between, we have a balance that allows for eminent domain in traditional uses, but strictly deals with those two narrow policy issues of private to private and protecting someone's home. We think we've done a very good job of vetting this bill. 7 hearings in Senate Judiciary alone, 22 total, numerous attorneys. With that, I guess we're open for questions. It has zero physical notes, so we could move it now, madam.
Okay, we'll do that.
That was just sort of threw that in to lighten it up.
I just wanted to verify that my earlier statement was correct on this version of the bill. Is a preferred version?
Yes, ma'am. It really does. There are several pieces of legislation working through the federal process now that would actually take away money from states that allow private-to-private transfers of any political subdivision. So we think that this body, the legislature, as the policymakers for the state, that should rest with the legislature and not with a municipality or any other governing body.
Thank you. Did you have anything you wanted to add at this time, or are you just for questions?
I'm here just for questions.
Thank you very much. Okay, are there any questions of the sponsor's office? We do have several people to testify. Wynn Menifee with DNR is on to answer questions. Luke Hopkins in Fairbanks.
Yes, thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'm on the Fairbanks North Star Borough.
Okay, if you could give your name and your association, please.
Yes, Luke Hopkins, Fairbanks North Star Borough Assembly Member. I wanted to speak against adopting version R. Our assembly, our process here in our local, in our Fairbanks North Star Borough has gone through a process of determining what our community wants to do with eminent domain. Similar to Anchorage, we passed language limiting eminent domain, and it was a local control issue, and it worked very well. We had a unanimous vote on our action. In speaking to the version R before you, I just heard that in testimony that this version R would strike the best balance on both sides, and I think that one piece that was left out is how well it would represent or determine what local municipalities across the state would be able to do when an issue of eminent domain came before them for specifically economic development concerns. And I'd just like to ask you please to consider the judiciary version that has the language in there that has a number of hurdles that the local municipality governing body has to jump over to ensure that it's fully vetted and is responsive to what local individuals want. And it includes the inability to have the Kelso case applied with assigning the powers of eminent domain to a private entity to handle or assign. So again, I ask you to please consider the Senate Judiciary version, which is, I guess, version P, and therefore not support this version R. Thank you, and I'll answer any questions that you might have.
Okay, did you have anything you wanted to respond to that, Peter? Is there any response?
Madam Chair, no, I don't.
Okay, thank you.
Senator
Stedman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm just kind of curious while we have the speaker online of what their thoughts are on any potential restrictions for a municipality when they extend water and sewer lines. A lot of times the water and sewer lines have free-flowing sewer. They'll go through properties with easements. They'll want easements, so they don't have to build lift stations. And I'm just wondering if they feel this bill would in any way hinder the development of utility systems in the areas that are on septic tanks and or some kind of water catchment systems.
Is that a question for me, Luke Hopkins in Fairbanks?
I believe so, yes.
The piece about the utilities, and I'm not an expert on utility easements, but I understand that that's not part of the bill, but again, it's not restricted in this bill because it would be an infrastructure placement. But again, I'm sorry, I don't have an accurate answer on that. And then adding the piece about septic tanks, I can't address that, but I would think that you, similar to our local Golden Valley and other utility infrastructure, that that would still be allowed to occur.
I think so, too. And any further questions?
Well, Madam Chairman, maybe I botched up the question. The question is, when the utilities want to expand into extend their trunk lines out, a lot of times they'll have to cross private property. Normally, you try to negotiate an easement, utilities easement through that property. And in the event that that's unattainable, I'm just wondering if this bill has any impact on that as far as the ability of a municipality or a city to try to deal with private landowners as they try to get their utility infrastructure in.
Greg, do you have any input on that?
Madam Chair, thank you. Senator Stedman, that is protected in this bill. One of the things we tried very hard to do was not affect any of the existing uses for eminent domain. So anything that existed prior to this bill will continue to exist with those limitations that we put on. I think if you refer to page 3 of the bill, line 10, it specifically mentions sewage of organized and unorganized boroughs, utilities and things like that would still be able to be the exercise of eminent domain would be able to be used to further that infrastructure. And the same is true with utilities and railroads, and it doesn't affect highways or development of hospitals or anything that's for the public good.
Okay, thank you. That answers your question. Peter, did you have anything to answer that? To add to that?
Madam Chairman, no, I, Mr. Johnson accurately.
Okay, thank
that.
You very much. And in this room, Ruth Blackwell wishes to testify. Ruth Blackwell?
Good morning.
You can give your name and your association.
I'm Ruth Blackwell. I am with the Alaska Association of Realtors. I work in Juneau at Powell Realty, and we are in support of version R. We feel that we're kind of 99% in favor. Of course, we would like to see no private land or private property go into public hands for the tax base and all. But normally, what we really feel is that a person's private property, if it's going to go back to private hands, it should go in through the system, through a buyer and a seller and that sort of thing, without the government getting into the mix. Right now, we have in private ownership in the state 99% or 1% of the land. 99% is owned by the state, the federal, the lands claim, and in that 99%, we should be able to find whatever land a municipality needs for economic gain. It's out there. So that is our position, and we're hoping that you will pass version R. And if you have any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions of Ruth Blackwell? Thank you very much for joining us today. Appreciate your testimony. Peggy Ann McConaughey? If I mispronounced your name, excuse me.
You did a wonderful job.
If you'll repronounce your name and tell us who you're with and begin your testimony.
You bet. My name is Peggy Ann McConaughey, and I am here also representing the Alaska Association of Realtors. First of all, let me quickly say we are very excited about Version R. Version R, in our mind, puts back the eminent domain bill as it originally was drafted and as we originally support. A couple things that I'd like to talk about is the Kelso case. The Kelso case was a clear taking of private property, no matter how they did it, shuffling it off to another committee, only to be reapproved by their assembly, but a clear case of taking private property for private purposes. What the Connecticut area tried to do was take property for economic gain in what we feel is the most ridiculous way possible. We understand and appreciate that all the municipalities within our great state would like to be able to have more local control. However, when it comes to private property rights, the private property owner should have the ultimate control over what happens to their property, and consequently, having Version R, where you take out paragraphs or sections 4 and 5, absolutely helps protect those private property rights. As you go along and think about this piece of legislation, I'd like to also have you think about something else. In 50 years, this is the bill you will be remembered for passing, not other bills. This is a very important issue to all of us as private property owners. Our house is sacred, and the ability to own it, to use it, to transfer it when we want to, is one of our basic rights, and we appreciate your protection of those rights. If you have any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Peggy? Thank you very much for
Thank
being
you
here.
Very much.
Kevin Ritchie?
Morning. Kevin Ritchie with the Alaska Municipal League. And first, I'd just like to say the Alaska Municipal League has no position on eminent domain. In fact, three of our largest communities, at least, have already acted on this issue, very similar to what you see in this bill. Our only issue is local control and making decisions at the local level where all the pros and cons can be weighed. As Mr. Hopkins in Fairbanks said, the bill that did receive a large number of hearings in Senate Judiciary did set out a process by which the legislature could absolutely guarantee that there was going to be a very substantial and fair public hearing, and that whatever decision was made would have to be approved by a supermajority of the body, two-thirds, three-quarters. You know, these are very weighty decisions. We certainly agree with the realtors that they are. But the only issue we have is local control. The one thing I did want to say, though, is in the case of the Kelo decision, that was in Connecticut, and we're not in Connecticut. Of the 10,000 cases that have been cited by the people that brought the lawsuit in the Kelo case, none of them anybody has found have occurred in Alaska. So we have been good stewards of eminent domain. So with that, I want to thank you for your time.
Thank you, Kevin. Any questions for Kevin? Thank you very much. Craig, was there anything else you wanted to say? Okay, well, when we get a quorum back, we'll act. Thank you. I do.
Madam Chair, working at it.
Senator Sandman.
Maybe with the other folks gone, they just relinquished all authority to us.
Well, unfortunately, that's not enough. I do remove my objection to Version R. And I will let them know really when they get back. Here comes Senator Dyson. Senator Dyson, I was just telling the committee I've removed my objection to Version R. Do you have any further questions on Version R of House Bill 318? Senator Dyson?
No objections, but I'm delighted.
Thank you.
Both with the bill and your actions on it.
Thank you. Would you like to make the motion to move the bill from committee?
Sure. I would be pleased. I move that we move HB 318 R version from committee. With individual recommendations, and I think a zero fiscal note.
Yes, thank you very much. Is there objection? HB 318 moves from committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes. House Bill 380. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Michael Pulowski, and I'm an aide for Representative Kevin Meyer. House Bill 380 is the product of a lot of working groups over the interim dealing with our statutes that relate to the powers of the state veterinarian and our animals and animal product statutes. The problem being in our statutes as they currently exist is that most of them were passed prior to 1949, pre-statehood, and at the time, animals were by and large considered livestock. And as the world has evolved, the definition of what an animal or an animal product is really has to evolve with it, particularly when we start to look at the issue of avian influenza and other zoonotic diseases that are very much in the forefront of people's consciousness. As we started to look at our statutes, we realized that the authorities for the department were inadequate and the definitions were unclear, and that the state was not in a position to react accordingly in the event of a crisis. So what House Bill 380 does is repeals and reenacts most of the provisions of Title III as they relate to animals and animal products and the power of our state veterinarian. The bill has been through a lot of committees, and there have been some very good changes to it. I believe it's a good product in front of you. There is a zero fiscal note. I believe we have the state veterinarian and members of DEC and the Public Health Department here to testify to it. The one thing that I'd add is that House Bill 380 is really one piece of the puzzle of how we are going to deal with things like avian influenza, because if you don't catch it at the animal level, that is where it can bleed into the human level. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd answer any questions the committee might have.
Are there any questions for the sponsor's office? I know early on in the process, I think when I was talking with, maybe it was Kristen, there was some questions that came up and some problems that existed and all. Can you kind of tell us how that was worked out?
Absolutely, Madam Chair. I think it was a good example of good effort and bad product. And what we did was the primary concern community is, of course, the agricultural community. And in trying to address their concerns, sometimes we went in the wrong direction. And I believe Senator Ralph Seekins in the Senate Resource Committee helped us come up with the best answer. And that you would find on page 2 and page 3. And it's section 0305011B3 and B4. And the issue was, by and large, what happens when the state comes in and quarantines or destroys an animal? There are existing statutes, but those statutes are completely inadequate. What happens is compensation is only allowed today for dairy cattle. And the levels of compensation in statute are limited by judicial district. And they are in the amount of $300, $400, $500. And Madam Chair, as you know, a dairy cow is worth a lot more than $300, $400, $500. So what we did is, in expanding the definition, said that the state may enter into agreements with the federal government for controlling disease among animals and match the federal indemnity payments that USDA commonly has as programs. But then also thinking about the diversity of animals that we deal with in Alaska, reindeer, for example, might not have a federal indemnity program. We put in 4, which allows the state to actually go so far as to pay an animal. Now, all of these would be subject to appropriation, but the way the sponsor views them, and I think the way they were added, is that it creates a vehicle for, in an emergency, the legislature to support its industry and support its community to solve a problem that really wasn't of their making.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Are there any other questions? Because you may have heard from some constituents early on that they had concern with it. And the other one was the appointment of someone other than the veterinarian.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. That was a concern. And that is found right above the previous citation, which is on page 2, lines 25 through 28. And that's the power to designate individuals. And the dilemma there, I believe, was fixed on line 26 and 27, which is under the direction of the state veterinarian. Mm-hmm. Now, imagining an avian influenza outbreak or an outbreak of foot and mouth disease that trends into reindeer or another animal, the state veterinarian needs to have the power to cooperate with municipal officials, local veterinarians, but there should be a responsible party. And in this case, that would be the state veterinarian would oversee any action taken.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Are there any questions? Okay, we do have some folks to testify. Christian, would you like to come testify now, or would you like to wrap up after the... Okay, thank you. Off-net is Bob Gerlach, who's a state veterinarian. Bob, would you introduce yourself, give your position, and begin your testimony, please?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. This is Bob Gerlach. I'm the state veterinarian for Alaska, and I'm calling in from Anchorage. The current statute will allow me to control the spread of contagious disease, but only in livestock, commercial poultry, and animals on fur farms. So House Bill 380 now will increase the authority to help protect the animal resources of the state, both the domestic animal resources and the wildlife resources, as well as public health in the state. This bill is complementary to House Bill 95, which was passed by the legislature in 2005. And House Bill 95 allowed public health officials to control the spread of contagious and potentially deadly diseases in people. So it's very similar to that bill. In the past, we looked at infectious diseases, and the regulations in place to control these diseases in animals were categories according to a convenient but really artificial system. We looked at diseases of livestock, diseases of wildlife, diseases of pets, and diseases of people as separate. The fact is that infectious diseases are rarely restricted to an individual group or species of animals. They are definitely not contained by any artificial or geographic boundary as well, so they can spread very rapidly. With the current pace of disease emergence in the 21st century, we've seen new challenges for the management and control of animal and public health diseases. We recognize that over 70% of these recent infections affecting people are zoonotic diseases. So they're diseases that come from animals that can infect people and can be shared back and forth. These diseases can have great effect on animal health, food production, human health, and both local and national economies. So the impact is very widespread and very important for all people concerned as well as industry. We know the diseases can be introduced into Alaska through a different routes from importation of animals or importation of animal products, whether it's dairy products, meats, or feeds. As well as animal movement, importation of livestock, or even migration of wild animals, whether it's wild animals crossing the border from Canada to Alaska, or the concern for migratory waterfowl possibly bringing avian influenza into the state. We had the concern several years ago for West Nile virus being brought in by birds flying into the state. So the most striking example, as I said, is avian influenza in the concerns that we need the authority and we need the authority to provide protection for the animal resources as well as the people of the state. And I would say that basically the current authority is very limited to infectious disease control in livestock, commercial poultry, and animals on fur farms. And right now that there is no state agency that has the authority to manage all groups or categories of animals, both the domestic livestock, pets, wild animals, or even exotic animals that may be on displays in zoos or other confined areas. So we need to have the authority to have capable control of any of these disease-carrying threats to the state's animal resources as well as the public health concerns of the state. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for the state vet? Thank you very much, Mr. Gerlach.
Thank you, ma'am.
Louisa Castrodale in Anchorage.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to address the committee. My name is Dr. Louisa Castrodale, and I'm testifying on behalf of Dr. Richard Monsager, the Division Director of the Alaska Division of Public Health. We'd like to offer our full support for House Bill 380. Our department works very closely with the State Veterinarian's Office to collaborate on disease investigations that affect both animal and human health. We believe this bill will strengthen that collaboration. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for testifying. Are there questions for Dr. Castrodale? Christian Ryan.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Kristen Ryan. I'm the director for the Division of Environmental Health, and I really have nothing, I think, to add at this point. I think you've heard basically all the facts of the legislation, so I'm just available for questions.
Okay. Are there any questions for the department? What's probably the most significant change you made to get it to where people would accept and were more willing to work with us, with you?
Madam Chairman, there were a lot of changes made to make people more accepting of the legislation. I mean, broadening the definition of an animal that can be quarantined by the state vet from livestock to all animals has a big impact. And I think a lot of people, though, are so nervous about the impending doom of avian flu or other diseases that seem to be coming our way on a continual basis that a lot of people were more generally supportive of the bill, especially when we added the indemnity clause so we could reimburse if animals were taken. And then, of course, as Mike Pulowski has said, the no action taken without the state veterinarian's approval, it was very significant. You want a veterinarian to make those decisions who are ethically bound by their code of no harm to animals to determine if an animal should be euthanized or quarantined. Mm-hmm. So by adding those two stipulations, I believe we've met all of the concerns addressed.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions for Kristen? Okay, thank you. Is there any other information that anyone needs on this particular subject? If you've read through the book, you'll be ready and willing to pass this on. Senator Bundy, can I get a motion, please?
Yes, ma'am. And it is a fascinating book. things that are fit for
more
human consumption,
know,
but questionable. I would move that we report from Finance, Senate, CS for House Bill 380 with attached zero fiscal note and individual recommendations.
With no objection, House Bill 105 as amended through the process. And the
380.
I'm sorry, 380. And
we move 105 at the same time.
We could do them all. And individual recommendations. Thank you. Passed from committee. Brief at ease. On the record, next is House Bill 105, and we have Senator Wilkin with us now, and Senator Olson was, and he'll be back, and we have people in various committees this morning, so it's that time of year. And Bill, are you doing the presentation? Welcome.
With my colleague.
Oh, hello, Janet.
Good morning. For the record, my name's Bill Hogan. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of Health and Social Services, and my colleague is
Janet Clark, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Health and Social Services.
Welcome.
Thank you. What we're proposing is a change to the range of adult dental services that are allowed under the Medicaid program. Medicaid dental coverage currently provides solely for emergency dental care for adults, and that is for immediate relief of pain and acute infection. This often leads to extraction of teeth. The legislation proposes an enhancement that would include preventive and restorative dental care, things like exams, cleaning, tooth restoration, upper and lower full dentures. The expanded Medicaid dental benefit would be for the most needy Alaskans, those with disabilities, and seniors. We anticipate up to about 16,000 individuals currently enrolled in Medicaid that would benefit from this program. I should point out that the enhancement includes an $1,150 annual cap. I believe this is one of the first programs under the overall Medicaid program that does include a cap, a dollar cap, on the amount of service being provided or offered on an annual basis. There also is a three-year sunset in the proposed legislation. This will allow the department and the legislature to evaluate the effectiveness of the program. We want to look at things like participation, the true cost and value of the program. We, and Janet will talk a little bit more about the fiscal note, but we've been working actively with an array of stakeholders who consider this a significant issue within communities throughout Alaska, particularly the Mental Health Trust Authority And the Mental Health Trust Authority has helped with the state match for Medicaid regarding this particular program. My experience in working with mental health beneficiaries, particularly those experiencing behavioral health problems and developmental disabilities, indicates that annually between 700,000 and $800,000 our mental health dollars are spent through their mini grant program to assist these beneficiaries in obtaining dental care. And obviously, if this were to pass, then those dollars could be better spent for other beneficiary needs. Let me also point out that the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation indicates that they're spending about $100,000 annually to help individuals on their roles obtain dental care to increase the likelihood that they would be or could be employed. So with that, I'll defer to Janet to talk a little bit about the fiscal note, okay, and then be available for questions.
Thank
good
you.
Morning. Good morning, Janet.
Madam Chairman, we have a fiscal note on this legislation, and I wanted to tell you that we've worked extensively in the House Finance Committee to review our assumptions, and in doing so, the fiscal note changed downward from the original fiscal note that was submitted by the governor. I'd like to explain some of the changes that we made in the assumptions for the fiscal note. First of all, we had originally presumed that 35% of eligible recipients would participate in preventive dental care from the beginning. We changed that assumption because we know that there are some access issues, and we also believe that there will be a ramping up of services. So we've spread that out until year three. We get to the 35% participation, but in year one and year two, it is less than that. Madam Chair, we also looked at what we're currently spending on emergency dental coverage and reduced that, again, in year two and then in year three, based on the assumption that as individuals get preventive dental care, they will not need the emergency services, and so we reduced the fiscal note because of that. Also, when we originally did the fiscal note last year, it was when we thought that our FMAP was going to be reduced to 50%. It did not, as you know, and so we adjusted that back to the current FMAP percentage of 57.58%. And then a key part of the fiscal puzzle was that the Mental Health Trust Authority agreed to retain their same level of funding for the years in the fiscal note. So as you look at the fiscal note, you can see that the Mental Health Trust Authority is going to provide $425,000 in year one, which is FY07, $1,425,000 in year two, which is FY08, and $1,425,000 in year three, which is FY09. FY2007, the fiscal note, is also reduced because we do not believe we'll have the regulations in place for the service to begin until approximately April 1st of that year. So we've reduced the fiscal note that way as well. So Madam Chairman, where we are, if you look at fiscal year 2008, what you'll see is that the state general fund match would be $1.3 million, and our estimate is that would leverage a total of almost $10.3 million in services based on the Mental Health Trust Authority providing their funds and all the other changes that I described. And of course, the last change on the fiscal note, Madam Chairman, is the three-year sunset. So we only show the cost through fiscal year 2009 for the services. So I appreciate the work of everyone in looking at the fiscal costs and helping us try to look at the having a less impact on the state general fund.
Thank you. Senator Dyson?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I was wondering if, Janet, if you could just quickly summarize for me what it takes for the income level and asset level for a non-mental health, non-disabled, non-elder adult to qualify for this benefit.
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, I'd have to get you those details, but typically, if you don't fall into one of those eligibility categories, if you're age 21 through 64 and you're not disabled and you don't have children, then you basically don't qualify. for Medicaid.
That sounds like good news. That's contrary to my memory, but I would trust yours better than mine. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Senator Wilken.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two different things. What has been the efforts on behalf of the department to work with the Alaska Dental Association to get them to allow temporary dental licenses for those dentists from outside Alaska that wish to come to Alaska to our rural areas and perform basic dental services during the summer? What's the extent of that effort from the department?
Senator Wilken, through the chair, I believe Dr. Brad Whistler, who is the dentist for the department, is online and could probably answer that question. Brad?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Wilken. In terms of efforts, I know both the community health center dental programs and the tribal dental programs in the state have approached that issue with the dental board. I know the dental board is looking at courtesy licensure, which is somewhat different than temporary licensure, but the issue is out there. It's not been an issue for our department that we've pushed real hard on. We've mainly been relying on the partners to work with the dental board on that issue.
All right, and I would also offer that the courtesy licenses are not what I'm speaking of. Where does it rest with the dental board for temporary licenses to be granted for people that want to come help Alaskans?
Through the chair again, Senator Wilkins. My understanding is I have not attended the dental board meeting, so this is speaking secondhand at this point, but I believe that the only issue that's being addressed by the dental board at this time is the courtesy license issue. I don't believe they're addressing the temporary licensure issue.
Do you, sir, plan on asking the dental board to grant temporary licenses that could take care of some of our more indigent people what amounts to volunteers?
Speaking for the department, I would be happy to bring up that issue. Just to briefly explain to the committee the difference, temporary license would actually be for a dentist that has a license in another state, and it would allow them to come into Alaska and practice until the board has a chance to meet and do licensure by credentials, so it would cover them during that period. Courtesy license that they're looking at, my understanding is, it would have some of that aspect, but it would not allow either the dentist or who they're working for to bill for their services. So it would really fit more with volunteer efforts than it would the community health center or tribal programs that are trying to get a dentist on board.
Madam Chair, I wonder if I could ask on behalf of the committee that the doctor please send a letter to my office in regard to the efforts on behalf of the state to get to enable temporary licenses in Alaska, if it can be done, the steps that are needed to be done, and the benefits that the department sees. And then I'd like to be copied with any correspondence back from the dental board. If that'd be all right.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, the other thing is, I'm reminded of the old saying, those that forget history are doomed to repeat it, and here we go again. In my short time here, I just have to refer the committee back to Denali KidCare that was presented to us with a firm number of expenditure, and that has far exceeded, for all sorts of reasons, what we expected it to be. I can then think of the PCA program that has grown from an $8 million program to an $80 million program in 6 short years. So I'm worried about this, and I appreciate the cap, but we don't know how many people are going to use it. So I talked with Janet yesterday, and in order for this to get my support, it'll have to have some sort of a limit. It'll be a separate line item in the budget, and there'll be some sort of a limit of the money expended, so that when all the monies are gone, then the program will stop, regardless of where we are in the year, and that will give us a hard indication of just the demand. So I would offer that, Madam Chair. I don't know how to do a conceptual amendment, but I would certainly ask that we hold the bill until we can have some sort of a hard cap as far as what is this going to cost us each year for the next 3 years.
Okay. Thank you, Senator. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Continuing down that same line of questioning, I was wondering what the department's views were or stance was on the dental hygienists and the licensing process that they're going through after they've been trained overseas.
Senator Olson, again, through the chair, I would defer to Dr. Whistler.
Dr. Whistler?
Through the chair, the issue where it relates to our departments is our department doesn't deal with licensure or with the dental board has mainly been around looking at the issue of Medicaid financing and reimbursement for those providers that are practicing under general supervision of dental staff. The department's had many activities in the past in terms of expanding tribal capacity. So in the past 2 years, we've been generally supportive of that program as it fits with tribal expansion and provision of care to Indian Health Service beneficiaries in the state.
Madam Chairman, just one comment. So if Dr. Whistler, I can just tell my constituents and those people that are subscribing to the IHS program that you are in support of the program?
Through the chair, in terms of the department clearly has been supportive in working with the program and has ongoing work with the Indian Health Service. In terms of my personal view, in terms of the dental officer for the state, I know that this model has worked in a number of other countries, including New Zealand, Australia, Great Britain, a number of the Pacific Islands. I think that given the dental access issue, not only in Alaska and other states, there's a variety of programs that are looking at other ways to address the dental access issue. The American Dental Hygiene Association is proposing an expanded dental hygiene model to address some of these same issues. So I think that the program has been proven to work in other areas of the world, and given that we're seeing access issues in the United States, I think that many areas are trying to address this issue. So I think it's something that clearly needs to be looked at in terms of the concept that the dental therapists are trying to do, not only in Alaska, but in other parts of the country. And there's been a lot of discussion on this between private dentistry and public health dentists that are trying to meet the underserved. So I would say personally, I think this program is workable. It needs to be evaluated to be sure that this is an appropriate model for the state, but I'm personally supportive that it move forward.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Are there other questions for the department? Dr. Whistler, do you want to go ahead and give your regular testimony, or
I was just on the line for questions, Madam.
Okay, thank you very much. And also, in Anchorage is Stephanie Birch. If you would give your name and your who you represent and begin your testimony. Stephanie Birch.
Hi, Madam Chair. This is Stephanie Birch. I'm just here for questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us and being available for questions. And in this room, we have, I think it's Andy Pope. Good morning. If you give your name and who you represent, begin your testimony.
First, I'd like to thank the chair for bringing this bill forward and the committee for hearing it. I am obviously a senior. Seniors of Mountain View, where I live, have been tracking this issue for some 18 months. I do not speak for all seniors. I speak as an individual. But I've been very involved with this, and I have a viewpoint that's formed by things I've heard in the last 18 months. Most of what I'm going to say, and it will be brief, is obvious, but there comes a time when it's necessary to restate the obvious to make sure that it's understood. Seniors, low-income seniors, are probably the only class in the state excluded from the dental health care. The natives have the native corporation. Employed people have their insurance. We cannot buy private insurance. It's way beyond our means, even if it was available. There are programs for alcoholics, narcotic addicts, but not low-income seniors. This is an overdue benefit. It's a well-constructed bill that I feel and other seniors feel because the economic threat, if you will, of growing out of proportion is in the bill. It has a safety cap, which also is helpful because it encourages seniors to go into their own pocket to complete the dental work. You're not going to get full restoration for $1,100. $1,100 and your permanent fund will get you in the door and have the work done. The problem is this threshold. Where can you find a dentist that will let you get something done for a down payment. I doubt very seriously if there's a threat to this program running out of control. All individuals are treated the same. The cap is reasonable at $1,150, and it is, has a time-certain cutoff date. Naturally, I encourage you, please pass this. It's long overdue. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pope, for joining us today. Appreciate your being here. Dr. White? Can you give your name and title, please, and begin your testimony?
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Dr. Katinka White, and I'm here today in support of House Bill 115 on behalf of the Alaska Primary Care Association, which represents 24 healthcare organizations operating 115 nonprofit community health centers and other safety net providers, throughout Alaska. They offer health care and dental care to Alaskans, including the uninsured, underinsured, underserved populations in the state. I am speaking to you on behalf of Alaskans that remain untreated victims of our nation's silent epidemic, oral disease. Dental caries and periodontal disease are infectious diseases caused by the transmission of bacteria from the parent to child or from partner to partner. In the year 2000, in the publication Oral Health in America, the Surgeon General released a milestone report that provided overwhelming evidence of this epidemic. It emphasized that the mouth is a point of entry for infection, which can spread to other parts of the body, and pointed to emerging associations between oral diseases and other physical ailments, such as diabetes, heart disease, strokes, adverse pregnancy outcomes, including low birth weight babies. The report makes it clear that oral health is integral to overall health. Oral health care represents the most frequently reported unmet health need among low-income persons. The inability to access proper health, dental health resources has had devastating personal consequences for many Alaskans, including severe oral facial pain, infection, impaired ability to eat, poor diet, nutritional status, speech difficulties, lost work days, and unnecessary tooth loss. Currently, dental services for adults are limited to the relief of pain and infection only. These services do not include root canals, resulting in the extraction of most teeth. Many individuals would rather live in continuous pain than have their teeth extracted because of the social consequences of oral disfigurement diminishes their self-image and sense of self-worth. Adults without adequate dental care resources express a feeling that their lack of dental coverage and resulting inability to get appropriate dental care reflects society's lack of recognition of them as people with intrinsic value. The Surgeon General's report also noted this relationship between oral facial disfigurement due to oral disease and the associated social stigma, low self-esteem, and anxiety experienced, which in turn limits their educational, career, and marriage opportunities. Among adults seeking jobs, those with visible caries and missing teeth were less employable than those with healthy smiles, resulting in increased numbers of adults on state-funded ATAP, unemployment, and food stamp programs. In closing, oral health means much more than healthy teeth. Oral health is integral to the general health and well-being of all Alaskans. Not allowing dental care benefits that include prevention and routine dental care knowingly puts our most vulnerable citizens at a greater health risk. Alaska cannot afford these long-term financial and human welfare costs. Alaska Primary Care Association and the Municipality of Anchorage support House Bill 105 and believe it's time for the dental Medicaid program to be restructured to include preventative and restorative services. Thank you.
Thank you for being here. If any questions for the doctor? Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, let me thank you for the little middleman that I have in my office that the Primary Care Association gave each of the legislators. It's been a constant source of frustration for 4 months. So thank you for that. And thanks for being here this morning. Has the Primary Care Association approached the Dental Society to encourage them to allow temporary dental licenses to serve some of the people of which you speak?
I'm not really sure that they have approached the Dental Society. as far as temporary licenses. And as far as I know, the Alaska Dental Board has not addressed, like Dr. Whistler had said, the fact to support temporary licenses. The Alaska Primary Care Association does take a stand with the dental health aid program, and that they are very much in support of it. And I personally am in very much support of this dental health aid program. Having worked up in many of the remote bush villages and having worked directly with a few of the individuals that went to the dental health aid program, they're very skilled and very knowledgeable, and they have a great rapport with the individuals that live in the villages.
If I could, ma'am, I think your voice would be, your organization's voice would be very powerful to bring that issue to the dental board, the dental society, to try to accomplish some of the goals that this legislation also tries to accomplish. So perhaps next year we could talk more about it, but I would certainly ask you to take a look at it, see how other states do it, and see if Alaska can't follow some of their models to allow dentists to come and serve some of the less able of our society.
No, I think it's a great idea, and we would really like to get something like that going as well, because a lot of our community health centers are underserved, and that's a big problem for us. And that's one of the programs that I'm working on right now. We've formed an Alaska Oral Healthcare Partnership, and we're trying to work on getting more dental care and better retention in the state.
Okay. Thank you for being here. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Senator Dr. Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Are there just are there any dentists that are with the Alaska Primary Care Association?
That work? That would be me.
You're the only one.
Yeah. That's right now, like I said, we started this program. We got some grants to put together this oral health network, where we're trying to improve access to dental care by getting more of a cohesive structure with the community health center dental clinics, getting together a shared provider program where we're trying to get improved access for dental care, and you know, working on a lot of other aspects so that we can get better dental service through our organization.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Are there other questions? Thank you very much for joining us.
Welcome. Thank you very much for your time.
Jeff Jesse.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Jeff Jesse. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, and I want to thank you for bringing this bill before the committee. I'll make my testimony brief. I want to just reiterate why the Mental Health Trust is so interested in this bill in particular and in dental services in general. Many of our beneficiaries have tremendous dental needs. We have, as Deputy Commissioner Hogan pointed out, we have a mini grant program every year that provides grants of up to $3,000 directly to individual beneficiaries for a wide range of things that they might need. It could be a laptop computer, it could be a car to get to work, it could be other things that they need to improve the quality of their life. We were stunned, frankly, when we discovered that nearly 70 to 80% of that funding was being requested for dental services. And if you think about what it means to an individual, if somebody offers them up to $3,000 for a pretty wide range of possibilities, and many of them say, well, what I would do if I had some money is I would go to the dentist. That's not usually way up on people's lists of things they want to do in their spare time or with any additional dollars they might have. So we've worked very hard with the department to construct a bill that, in our opinion, does have as many cost containment provisions as we could craft, including not only, of course, the cap on services, but also the sunset provision. In our opinion, this is a very important bill. It isn't the only thing that we're doing in the dental arena. We are working also on donated dental programs, trying to assist in getting dentists to contribute their efforts towards dental care and providing reimbursement for their out-of-pocket expenses. We are developing partnerships with community health centers to get them up and running on providing more comprehensive dental care. But this funding mechanism is critical to many of those efforts if we're going to be successful in meeting the dental needs of our beneficiaries. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. Are there any questions for Jeff Jesse? Thank you very much. Mike Ford, you're just for questions? Thank you. And so that concludes our testimony, public testimony on that bill. And Senator Wilkin will hold this and see if we can come up with the desired language that you're looking for.
Thank you.
Thank you. And moving on to House Bill 16. Motion to adopt Senate Finance Version C. Senator Wilkin.
Madam Chair, I would move that the committee adopt Senate Committee Substitute for Committee Substitute for House Bill 16 Version C as in Charlie dated 4/30/06 as our working document.
Okay. And I'll object for explanation and go ahead and
thank you, Senator Green. My name is Reneva Moss, legislative aide for Representative Coghill. I apologize, Representative Coghill had to leave because session is about to start. About 5 years ago, Representative Coghill spent most of the summer in Nenana doing some remodeling of a building in Nenana, and he had the opportunity to work with some young students who had come from Nenana boarding school. And he listened to their stories about how successful they were by coming to Nenana boarding school and how they had changed their opinion of where they were going in life and how they wanted to be productive citizens. And that really wasn't their opinion of life before they came to that school. So Representative Coghill got interested in the so-called boarding school concept, and this is kind of the product of that, and it has come through a lot of discussion. Senator Wilkin has been very instrumental in assisting in getting the Department of Education and the Education Board to actually propose regulations that will regulate these boarding schools. But Representative Coghill sees this as an issue of choice and an opportunity for students all over the state to enter into a program that can basically change their life. And just to show you the success, the class of 2005 in Nenana, there were 14 graduates. 11 of those graduates went on to post-secondary school with financial assistance. 2 enlisted in the Marines and 1 entered the Job Corps. So you had 14 graduates, all of which improved their life and became productive, ongoing citizens. This piece of legislation in the Senate CS would basically establish that any school, boarding school, that was established, and I might say that they're not really boarding schools, we're calling them by regulation, statewide secondary residential programs. If that was established prior to January 1, 2005, they could be reimbursed for operating the residential program through a stipend. And the requirements are that they have a suitable student dormitory. They provide daily access to public school offering grades 9 through 12, and they have to be a full-time school. The stipends, if you look at the CS, the stipends will be determined by a rate set by the Department of Education that cannot exceed the statutory limits that are on page 2, starting on line 8. The bill defines what a district is, and defines district-operated statewide residential educational programs. And this CS, Madam Chair, brings the language of the bill in line with the language of the regulations, and it puts an effective date of July 1, 2006. We also have Eddie Jeans here that can answer questions and give more information.
Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Reneva, can I infer from your comments that you are you and the sponsor are comfortable with the changes made in the finance CS?
Through the chair, yes, Senator Dyson.
And if I may continue, and is it the sponsor's conviction that the stipends here are sufficient? Looks like you're saying that you can feed, clothe, and house a kid for $20 a day or less.
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, no. Representative Coghill feels that there's still a responsibility on the part of the parents in the school district to contribute also. So this is a portion of what the costs are.
All right. Thank you.
Senator Bundy.
Yes, thank you. And the stipend goes to the school district, not to the individual.
Through the chair, that's correct.
Yeah. An additional question. Why the inclusion of the round trip? I would think that, again, when you have personal buy-in, you are more dedicated to the project, and so if someone had to pay their own way, maybe this would be even greater incentive to achieve.
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, most of these students come from very remote areas, and the cost of travel is fairly expensive. These are students that probably have a trip home during Christmas or through a break. There may be two or three trips home, so this is just one trip that the school would provide compensation for. And again, this probably doesn't cover, I'd hate to say a percentage, Eddie may be able to give you more facts on that, but that this covers a very small part of taking care of those students.
Yeah, Madam Chair, it appears to me to be kind of a marketing tool. Say, come to our school, we'll give you a free trip. I'm a little concerned about that provision.
I think the Lord has spoken on that last comment, Madam Chair.
Yeah, and he agreed with me.
Who was that preacher that said the invocation yesterday?
Okay, now, let's see. So in addition to the stipend and the trip, there's also the regular funding for an individual, a student account, and the base student allocation.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple things, if I could. Regarding the fiscal note, if we turn to page 2, I don't think it's correct, and Eddie could help with this, of course, but I think we want to be exactly correct. We want to take lower Kuskokwim out because the Bethel program is no longer part of this bill, so we might want to review that with Eddie. The other, or I guess we could do that right now.
Yes, sir. Welcome. Give your name and title.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Eddie Jeans. I'm the Director of School Finance. Senator Wilkin is correct. The fiscal note will be amended to $1,079,000 with the removal of Bethel.
Okay. We need a motion for that, or is it just corrected? Okay, thank you. Anything else, Senator Wilkin?
If I could
go right ahead.
Just to direct the committee to page 1, line 9. And a couple of years ago, after the session was over, I was headlines in the Fairbanks paper that I had stopped the funding for the Indiana boarding school because of my concern about the boarding school issue. And so I was really tired of slinking down in my seat driving through Indiana. So I have worked with folks, and I just want to say thank you to Reneva and to the department to take care of some of my concerns, and they have. And the reason I refer to you to that line is that you can see under regulations is part of this now. And in your packet, you have something that looks like this, which is the regulations that are currently out for review. This is the effort on behalf of the department to encourage the State Board, which had, despite numerous occasions to encourage them to do something, didn't. But now they have this, these regulations are out, and they essentially, pardon me, they draw some rules under which if someone comes to us, pardon me, comes to us and wants to put a boarding school in, there's some criteria, and the state gets to analyze whether it's in the best interest of the state. My concern has been, and I know we're going to be driven to something called a boarding school, and frankly, I don't agree with that term, and I'm glad we're trying to change it. I suggest a prep school, but NCLB is going to drive us to a slightly different model in that we're going to have to take some of our kids from outlying areas and get them in a learning environment for perhaps not a year, but perhaps measured in months, that they can receive the curriculum and the education they need to perform on the world stage that they can't in their local community. But my concern is that communities could do that for a couple of reasons. One, they want to keep their kids home, because they don't want their kids to go off to a prep school. And the other is just plain old economic development. And we have King Center and Hutchinson and Kotzebue and Nome, Bethel, Seward, Galena. So we've got these facilities out there, and we need to develop those and let them mature for us to grow into NCLB and the needs that are surely going to come upon us. And last night there were some difficult votes at the capital budget, but one of the ones that was most difficult for me was to say no to St. Mary's, who was trying to do exactly what we're talking about right here. Bless their hearts. But anyway, I just want to say thank you. If these regs don't come back intact, then we'll have another discussion next year. But they're good, and everyone signed off on it. And with that, I'm very supportive of this bill and Representative Coghill's efforts to take us to the next step in rural education. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Bundy.
Madam Chair, Senator Wilkin mentioned the fiscal note, and now just a little over $1 million. And I have amendment number one, that I'd like to move that would provide funding for that $1 million.
We do need to. I will remove my objection to the adoption of the CS so that you can move forward with your amendment.
I have moved Senator. Amendment number one.
Object.
Oh, there is an objection. I thought this was going to be a simple little amendment.
Would you like to explain?
Madam Chair, as Senator Wilkins pointed out, I'm sure we're going to expect to see a number of boarding schools erupt, and they will be in areas of REAAs where the folks unfortunately haven't chosen to accept their personal responsibility to support their schools. And when they want boarding schools, I suspect then that the cost should be part of the equation, and so I've moved amendment number one.
Okay, and there's continued objection? Yes. Does anyone else want to speak to the amendment?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I think I can speak for my representative in saying that he would oppose this. There already is an existing stipend that's being paid for students that come into boarding schools. This simply broadens it so that more students have the option of going into these residential schools. But I think he would tell you that he feels like this is a whole separate issue that doesn't belong in this piece of legislation.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, I'd point out that I think the vast majority of these children that go to these boarding schools will come from REAAs, where they are currently not helping support schools. So perhaps that would be double dipping even. So.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. As I look at this amendment, it looks like it's say it diplomatically, something that I can't support, obviously. I think that anybody that supports this bill is not certainly, at least the feeling that I get, is not dealing with the spirit of the original bill, House Bill 16. And so because of that, I voice strong objection to the amendment.
Is there any other comment? Robin, would you call roll, please?
Senator Hoffman?
No.
Senator Olson?
Absolutely not.
Senator Dyson?
No.
Senator Stedman?
No.
Senator Bundy?
Yes.
Senator Wilkin?
Yes.
Senator Green?
Yes.
3A, 4A.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
A conceptual amendment, if you will, amendment number 2, striking page 2, lines 2, 3, and 4, the free round trip ticket.
You want to delete that?
I'd like to delete the free round trip ticket.
Okay, there's a conceptual amendment to delete lines 2 through 4, the round trip ticket. Discussion? Is there objection?
I'll object.
Yeah. Yeah. Madam Chair, as I said before, as previous discussion has indicated that I view buy-in as important. Some other people do not. And free lunches die hard, but this is an attempt to encourage people to invest in their own education, and the result, I think, is that we all then work harder when we have a personal investment.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I believe that Representative Coghill would speak in opposition of the amendment. NENANA requires the parents to come up with $1,000 of their own money to help pay for room and board for their children. There are exceptions in hardship cases where they can get waivers. However, these are students that can't get in a car and drive to the school. They're traveling hundreds of miles by air, the only source of transportation they have from these communities. And it is an extra hardship for them to get there. But like I said in my testimony, this is an option, but it's an option that is turning out productive Alaskans that without this opportunity, probably at a future date, would be a burden to the state.
And wrap up, if I might. I'm just concerned that there may be those who say, I'm not happy in this small village. I'm not getting along with mom or dad or whatever, and here I get a chance for a free trip to town, and there may be those who view it as that way, and I think that would defeat the purpose of what the bill is trying to achieve.
Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We tussled with this when we were working with the bill, and where we finally came down was that this isn't exactly the Mount Edgecombe model, but it's close, and we of course pay that round trip ticket, I think, Eddie, to Mount Edgecombe, and the thought was that we have a wait list at Mount Edgecombe, and perhaps if we at least have some equality among the two schools in regard to transportation, that you may lift a few off of that wait list and get them to NENANA and take the pressure off of Mount Edgecombe. So in the interest of doing that and to treat both of these programs the same, I supported leaving that in there and put in the words least expensive so that we recognized really what that small cost was going to do.
Other comment? Okay, Robin, would you call roll, please, on amendment number 2?
Senator Dyson?
No.
Senator Bundy?
Yes.
Senator Hoffman?
No.
Senator Olson?
No.
Senator Stedman?
No.
Senator Wilkin?
No.
Senator Green?
Yes.
2A, 5A.
So amendment number 2 has failed. Eddie Jeans, if you'd begin your testimony, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. quite frankly, Senator Wilkins stole all my thunder.
He did.
Yes, he did. We've worked very hard with the State Board of Education in developing regulations that would limit the number of communities that could participate in this program to Nenana and Galena. The regulations would also require that before any other school district could attempt to start operating a statewide program, the State Board of Education would have to determine a need and then go through an application process. And with the way that this legislation is currently written, that would also require an additional step of the department coming back to the legislature and asking for this particular piece to be expanded. So I think all the safeguards are in place that Senator Wilkin was looking for. We also included in our regulations an annual reporting of student demographics, as well as a number of students that enroll or accepted, and that is also extended to Mount Edgecombe. So we should be getting some really good data on these programs that we can share with the legislature in the near future.
I just recall in last night's document, there was, I think, $1 million for Galena and $1 million for Nenana in there. Is this in addition to that, or does this supplant that in the capital budget? Do you recall?
Madam Chair, it's my understanding that that is in addition, yes, for expansion of the dormitory facilities.
Are there any other questions on this legislation? Okay, we'll hold this over till tomorrow, please. I've got a couple of questions I want answered.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And the House Bill 218 will come before us another day. I believe that concludes all the testimony we have. We are adjourned.